Have you ever given thought to the shady link between government and human trafficking? Some of you might not be surprised, other of you may shrug your shoulders, and some of you may be asking, well, what's new? What's going on, everyone? Welcome back to Ramblings of a Sikh for our first time viewers brought here by the mysterious YouTube algorithm. What's going on? Oh, and don't forget to subscribe to our long-time supporters. Your ongoing support means everything to us, so welcome back. In today's episode, we're taking a deep dive into the world of guestwork programs guided by historian Cindy Hajamovic. We begin our journey in 19th century America, traverse across Europe, scrutinize their implementation in countries such as Australia, Venezuela, and South Africa, amongst others, and evaluate the continuing presence of these programs into the modern day. We address 16 important questions, including what are guest worker programs, what drove their creation, how do they differ from indentured labor or slavery, and how did government attitudes shape their development across the globe? This is a discussion you really won't want to miss. So, don't forget to watch this until the end as Cindy Hajamovic peels back the layers of state-sponsored human trafficking, unmasking the raw and real experiences of these workers. She exposes the underbelly of these programs, as well as bringing attention to the rare instances of guest workers courageously voicing their complaints in court. We've barely scratched the surface of this intricate history, so remember to stay with us to find out more, and don't forget to hit that subscribe button so you don't miss out on any future podcasts or videos. Now, with all that out of the way, let's get straight into it. What is guest work and what are guest work programs?
Well, a guest worker, and the term is a post-World War II German invention, Gastarbeiter. The programs go back earlier, but the term refers to state-authorized labor migrants, right? There's always been labor migrants. There's always been people moving around the world in search of work. But these are people who have essentially a government visa that lets them enter for a set period of time. But usually it's a terminal visa. So you can stay for a year or you could stay for 3 years, whatever it says on that visa, but then you must go home. Sometimes it can be renewed for a period of time, but often you can't. So there's no promise of permanence. It's meant to keep people temporary, to keep people sort of cycling in and out. And that, in a nutshell, is what a guest worker is. And they exist all over the world.
So what led to their creation?
When I first started researching these after the Yale student asked me about it, I thought they started during World War II. It's usually when we talk about them, it's what everybody who had written up to that point had said, World War II, World War II. But then as I dove into it, I kept finding programs that went back to World War I, and then even the earliest ones to the 1880s. And the key, I think, is that that was a period of heightened nationalism and heightened migration, right? It's easier to move around. You have railroads, you blasted canal, you know, the Panama Canal and the Suez Canal. It's faster to move. The boats are faster. So there's many more people migrating around the world. And that bumps up against nationalist movements that have already formed. And then, of course, they're mutually reinforcing, because the more migrants, the more nationalism. And so you get lots of calls in various places for immigration restrictions. And there never really had been any before. The first ones in the world begin in the United States and in Victoria, which becomes Australia, in 1882. And that's the Chinese exclusion. So a ban in the U.S. on not all Chinese, but all Chinese laborers. And then a very similar law in what becomes Australia at the same time. And then that kind of spreads around the world in what one academic has called a Great Wall against China. Well, once you have bans on one group of people, it's easy to sort of say, well, who else don't we want, right? So you get a whole string of immigration bans in all kinds of places. Venezuela, South Africa, everybody seems to, you know, to jump on the bandwagon. And they ban, you know, in the U.S., all Asians. In some places, people who are not literate, say in Australia, says not. If you're not literate in English, you can't get in. Anarchists, epileptics. It's a weird list. So you get these bans, and they get broader and broader. But at the same time, employers want to hire immigrant workers, and so you have these two competing interests. And guest worker programs are a state solution, right? The government kind of intervening between these two groups, nativists, anti-immigration people on the one hand, employers who want to hire immigrants on the other, and say, okay, well, here's the deal. We'll bring in these people, the employers can hire them, but they can't stay. They won't have to be educated. We don't have to deal with their children. We don't have to deal with them when they're old. They won't become citizens, and we can send them back whenever we want. So the first example of that I saw that's on a grand scale is Prussia in the late 19th century. In the 1880s, this is a decade after German unification, so not surprising that it's in a country kind of under construction, right? There were lots of complaints from nationalists about Poles in Prussia, which is ironic because Prussia had annexed part of Poland. So there was a good reason why there were lots of Poles in Prussia, but there were always more people. Poland had disappeared by this point, eaten up by its neighbors, but there were still Poles coming into Germany, into the big wheat fields, and then also into the mines. And so there was lots of complaints about the Polonization of Prussia. And so under pressure, Bismarck deported some 40,000 unnaturalized Poles, but that left the owners of these big wheat estates with no labor. And so for 5 years, they clamored to get them back. And then finally, they reached this compromise. The Poles can go back in, but they can only come back temporarily, only men. They had to have an ID card that identified them as Polish. They weren't allowed to to hold meetings in English. So no collaborating with Germans, no forming unions with Germans. So there are all these restrictions on them, and most importantly, they had to leave at the end of a set period of time. So that's our first sort of full blown guest worker program, and then I saw others in South Africa, another country under construction, in Australia, another country under construction, and then they kind of mushroom in World War One, and then in the 20th century, it just takes off in a big way.
How do these guest worker programs differ from, say, some of the indentured slavery that occurs kind of around a similar time? And equally, is it a matter of just which country is kind of involved that almost dictates what's happening?
Yeah, it's really, really, really similar. So if you take what becomes South Africa, they already have indentured migrants coming from India on a pretty massive scale. But the difference is, and they're treated, they have contracts. It's a state authorized program in much the same way, right? But at the end of those indentures, the people from India can stay. They're British subjects. They can stay. Now, they try to get them to leave by imposing, say, taxes on people who don't re-up as indentured servants or go back to India. And that was what Gandhi starts his career, his career as a independence leader begins with the fight against the treatment of coolies in South Africa, because these were discriminatory taxes. Why should Indians have to pay a tax for staying? But they can stay, and they do stay, and they stay all over the world. And that leads to lots of hostility in the case of South Africa from British people, of course, who are settling, who are happy to have what they call coolie labor, but they don't want to rub elbows and compete with free people, free Indian workers at the end. So in South Africa, the guest worker program that they devise at the end of the 19th century is a solution to that. How do we get migrant labor, but not have to keep them and be able to send them back whenever we want? And so we get this transition. So the two programs overlap. The whole system of indentured labor migration doesn't end until the 1920s, and the guest worker programs have already started in the 1880s. That was one of the things I found trickiest. I was like, what is the difference? And I wasn't expecting to find them overlapping, but alas, they really did.
So which kind of countries and what factors influenced then the kind of, I guess, the evolution of the guest worker program?
They evolved very little.
Oh, okay.
In fact, when I started working on this project, I wanted to put it in the context of indentured migration in the 19th century. And I was reading a book about an indentured worker in British Guyana, a man from India whose name was Betchu. And Betchu was incredibly literate. He didn't want to go to British Guyana. He got kind of duped into, he got charged while waiting in the immigration depot in India, and he couldn't pay the debt. So then the recruiter said, well, I really want you for, he thought he was going to go to Trinidad, and he ends up in British Guyana. And he's appalled by the treatment of his fellow coolies, as he would have said. And so he starts writing to the local paper, and he causes a huge stir. But at one point, one of his op-eds essentially was a list of the complaints of the coolie. And so I had written down the list. And then I had to be I was serving as an expert witness in an American guest worker case where two men had been brought from Peru to be sheep herders, and they were left on top of a mountain. This is in the 2000s, early 2000s. Left on top of a mountain in Colorado with thousands of sheep and no heat and no toilet and just like a little tiny trailer and a jug of water for months and months at a time. And so I was going through their depositions, making a list of their complaints, and darned if it wasn't the same list. I mean, exactly the same list. And I called the attorney in that case, their attorney, and I said, look at this. And she said, oh, is that from another case? I was like, it's from another case in the 1890s. She was like, holy crap. So the circumstances are really similar, except for this issue of the guest worker contracts tend to be shorter than indentured contracts were. They end up on average 5 years by the end of the 19th century. Guest worker programs are usually a year, maybe renewable to three. And then the big difference is when a coolie, when an indentured worker ran afoul of their employer, slept in late, didn't show up, absconded, broke a tool, spoke back, organized a strike, they would go to jail. So flogging was no longer legit. That was supposed to go away with slavery, although it didn't always do that. You went to jail, and your contract would be increased to make up for the time you were in jail, sometimes double. But if you're a guest worker and you run afoul of your employer, you generally get sent home. So the threat of deportation replaces the threat of imprisonment, which replaced the threat of the lash of sale. But they're all kind of versions of the same.
Yeah, it's really interesting how they're almost variations of one another, all kind of working at the same time.
They're all trying to solve the same problem, which is how do we get labor from across an ocean when the labor can't afford to get to where they're going? And in the case of slavery, of course, are not volunteers at all. But with indentured labor and guest worker programs, which I think are much more similar, people tend to be volunteers. Some people get kidnapped into it but they're often, I mean, people would tell me in Jamaica about how terribly they were treated. And then they would ask me, can I help them get a ticket at the end to go back? Because even if you're ripped off, it's still going to pay better than what you could make at home. And these are places with, you know, incredibly high rates of poverty. So they're just such similar systems, but they're just trying to solve the same problem. How do employers get labor from around the world when they can't just sort of advertise jobs and people will come?
I guess one question is how, but also then why do governments keep those type of infrastructures considering those complaints seem to have just not changed? Like the conditions have just seemed to have remained.
Well, they do change and they don't change. So for example, with people moving around the British Empire, say the indentured workers moving around the British Empire, there's all kinds of exposés because Britain's just abolished slavery, and then they create this system as an alternative. And then all these abolitionists say, wait a minute, this is a new system of slavery. This is terrible. And so there's enormous consternation, investigations, and ultimately the British stop the whole thing. They say, okay, we're suspending this until we can figure out what to do. And what they figure out, what they do is take over the whole thing. They nationalize it. So only British officials can recruit people, move people. The doctors have to be in the employ of the colonial state. Everything gets organized. They put protectors of immigrants in the sending countries and protectors of immigrants in the receiving colonies. It becomes this incredibly rule-bound system. However, if you bind workers to a particular employer and they cannot quit that employer, it doesn't matter how many rules you impose, it's going to be bad, right? And the guest worker model is the same. So in most places of the world, including in the United States today, when you get a guest worker visa, it's the employer who's getting the visa. Or in the Middle East, it would be the sponsor, not always the employer. And then that person gets to bring you in, and that person sends you back. Maybe not officially, but that's really how it works. So in the U.S., if you walk away from your employer, your visa is still good for a little bit, but you can't work anywhere else. And people arrive usually in great debt because they've been charged for the visa. It's not supposed to be, but it happens anyway. So the men I'm writing about now were from India. They came to the U.S. as steelworkers working in shipyards in Texas and Mississippi after Hurricane Katrina. So this is, they arrived 2007. And they've been promised green cards. So they've paid $20,000, $18,000 on average a pop for what they think is a legal green card, a legal green card process that will let them move to the U.S. with their families. But they actually arrive on temporary visas that bind them to one particular company, which was called Signal International. And then they discover nothing is what was promised. They were getting paid what they were promised, but like the housing was 24 men in a trailer. They're being charged $1,000 each plus a month for that little bunk bed and so on and so forth. When they walked away from that employer, now they're out of status. They can stay for the period of the visa, but they can't work for anybody else. If they extend beyond that visa, they're now undocumented. And even when they were at the employer could threaten them with deportation. Well, if you don't like it, we can send you home. Well, they can't go home because they've incurred this debt, and they can't make that money back in India. They can't even make it back. It would take years in the Middle East to make it back. And these are really highly skilled steel workers. These weren't farm workers, you know, cutting sugar cane. But they were stuck.
Obviously, the fact that there is this ability to deport the guest worker is a huge kind of issue in some senses in the system. But what other factors contribute to what seems to be kind of the abuse or at least the exploitation of these guest workers? Because they seem to have been kind of brought in on a promise that obviously didn't hold true, and in any legal capacity, like that's obviously that doesn't hold up. But yet they're still able to be. They would still, like as you were saying, as soon as they walk away, they almost rescinded what crappy deal they'd been given. So like how are people able to use this to their benefit, but also at the detriment of the guest worker?
Yeah, well, people do benefit from these programs. I mean, people aren't stupid, right? They wouldn't enter into these programs unless they knew they had a prospect of making far more money than they could make at home. And if you go back to, I have a stat from 2006 that the guest workers were... Their remittances was more than the government aid for four countries, right? If you added that all together, the guest workers are making more. So remittances are a lot. They're really important. Some people do fine, and they're very happy with the situation they find, right? But it's a crapshoot because you don't know. The person, the men that I'm writing about now, they thought they had done their due diligence. There was an internet by this time, right? So they had looked at the company. They had met its owner. They had met the American lawyer. It all seemed completely legit. I forget what your question was.
How are employers and others able to almost exploit these guest workers? Because these chaps were kind of brought in on a false promise. But then as soon as they stood away, as you were saying, their status is almost rescinded or blanked.
Well, the key, I think, is the two things, is the temporariness and then the fact that the people generally making the decision about whether this worker stays or goes is the employer. And we see this, the shift to that in the U.S. during World War II, because the program created during the Second World War was very government run. So the federal government was going to Mexico and to the British Caribbean, and they were interviewing people and doing their medical exams and feeling their hands to see that they were rough, because they wanted people who were experienced. They were going to be farm workers, so they wanted people who were experienced. They brought them, they housed them, they moved them, they did everything but employ them. And for that, you know, they would farm them out to employers who were supposed to follow various rules in terms of how they were housed and so forth. And for a little while, it works really well. In particular places in the U.S., there was so much labor demand during the war that marching bands, communities would meet the guest workers getting off trains with marching bands and hold fiestas for the Mexicans and buy domino sets for the Jamaicans. And it was just one big party. But then they went to Florida, and in Florida, they were met by chain gang bosses. They were housed in really terrible quarters, no pillows, sleeping on wood, and they were expected to sign what critics called the Jim Crow Creed. So basically a document that said you are going to obey the rules of white supremacy. You're not going to white churches, don't date white women, da, da, da. And that the pain of, you know, the punishment for rape is execution. I mean, it was quite the document. And so within a couple of weeks, 600 Jamaicans are in jail for refusing to sign this document, accept these conditions. And the federal government ships them home. And that changes everything. Because once employers knew that they could treat people in violation of the contract, and if they complained, you could just send them home, all bets are off. And it really hasn't changed since that time. So some employers are fantastic, right? And treat people with great respect and try to hire the same people back year after year after year. I mean, there are Jamaicans that would go to American apple farms, same ones, year after year, loved their employers, knew them. The employers would visit them in Jamaica. You know, it's not all bad. But if you're going to some new place, you don't know what you're going to find.
Yeah, no, definitely. I'm fascinated, though, to find out a little bit more about how these guest worker programs, especially considering much of the labor is coming from the global south, and most of these people look like they have a darker skin color than most Americans. How did that fit in with the whole, like, I know you just briefly mentioned about how they had these Jim Crow contracts. But how did these guest workers fit into that landscape of race relations, so to speak, in America from the early 20th century onwards?
It was one of the questions I had. So when I tried to ask the Jamaicans, like, what was your experience of the American Civil Rights Movement? Because I was interviewing people that had worked in Florida in the 1960s, and they had no idea what I was talking about. And I said, you know, Martin Luther King, March on Washington. And one of them said to me, oh, well, when Kennedy was assassinated, we all got deported. I was like, what? So, but they were very, very isolated in these camps. They could go in and out, but they were like barbed wire enclosed camps. You couldn't just go visit somebody. They were operated as sort of private property. So they often had, you know, just very little interaction with the people around them. During World War II, when all these Jamaicans arrived in, say, like the Midwest, the press, the white press, would write these stories about how these are not like our Negroes, which is the word they would use, right? Like, you have to treat them with kid gloves because they're different. And then the black press was like, wait, what? why don't you actually treat American farm workers nicely instead of just these people from Jamaica? So it's a sensitive issue. But not all guest workers historically have been people of color. So if you look after World War II in Europe, 30 million guest workers work in Europe in the aftermath of the war, in the two decades after the war, because there's enormous, people have been killed in such massive numbers. There's so many buildings and infrastructure that's just flat, right? And they need labor. And so the post-war governments are very quick to start importing labor. The bulk of the workers go to France and Germany, but like Switzerland is 37% guest workers after World War II. And they're coming, we think of Turks in Germany, but they're actually at the tail end. It's the people are coming from the rural periphery of Europe into the center. So they come from Ireland, they come from Italy, from Greece, from Yugoslavia, and so forth, into the industrial, what had been the industrial core before it all got blown up. What's different about that story, which I think is fascinating and maybe a model for how this could be done differently, is that in Germany, for example, and the circumstances were different in different countries, but Germany is importing the bulk of these people. This is where the Gastarbeiter term comes from, guest worker, because foreign workers were called, the Nazis called them Fremdarbeiter, so alien workers, and that seemed like a bad idea at this point. So guest worker sounded like a nicer, kinder, gentler term. But they separated the work visa and the residency permit. So when you arrived in, you had a work visa, a residency permit, so you had some dorm or whatever you were assigned to live in, and then this labor board would assign you to a company. But if things did not go well with that company, you didn't like them or they didn't like you, you didn't get deported, you went back to the labor board and they assigned you somewhere else. And the only way you got deported is if you committed a crime. The other key difference was that in Germany, the unions tried to block these guest foreign workers for obvious reasons, competition. And then when that didn't work, they cleverly concluded, well, if we can't prevent these people from coming, we better organize them. And so over the years, the unions fought for guest workers' rights to get them the same wages, the same collective bargaining rights, the same incredibly long paid vacations, and so forth. And they did. And they also gradually got family reunification rights as well, and the right to stay. So most of those people stayed, 70% of the people stayed, and just become Germans. Like, who knew there were millions of Italians in Germany, or millions of, that there were Irish people in Germany? We don't know, because they just sort of became Germans. They pulled the rug out from the Turks, and that's why we know about that story, because they did not want to give them family reunification. They did not want them to stay. And so those people had to fight for that. And so it's a very different story, and it sticks out in our, understanding of this whole thing. But the German model could be a model for how this could work much better. We certainly have to take the profit-making bit out of the recruitment, because as these programs have proliferated around the world, we've seen the rise of for-profit recruiters. So instead of American officials going to the Caribbean or Mexico to recruit people, it's private recruiters dealing with private recruiters. And nasty things. So you can't control the promises that are made, right? The promises can be totally out of sync with the reality. And that's where a lot of the fees are going. So like the men coming to work for the shipyards in the US, the recruiter told, there was an American recruiter and an Indian recruiter, and they told the company, you don't have to pay anything. The workers will pay for everything. And they did, including giant fees for those recruiters and the lawyer that did the paperwork. So a lot of the real exploitation has gotten much worse because of the rise of these for-profit recruitment companies. But that doesn't mean the employers don't have responsibility. And they've been held responsible for the false promises that were made. So in the case of the shipyard workers, Signal International settled out of court for $20 million. It's the biggest human trafficking judgment in U.S. history, as far as I can tell, and declared bankruptcy. And, you know, not a lot of people got paid. But anyway, you know, there can be consequences for what your recruiters say. And in the case of Signal, they knew what was being said. There's lots of evidence of that.
Are they an anomaly, though, in terms of like actually how, like, I guess where the question is coming from is that the guest worker normally isn't in a position of power. So is this case an anomaly in it actually going so far in terms
yes.
of?
Yes. Okay. Yes. It was an enormously expensive enterprise. It always is to sue your employer. In this particular case, the Southern Poverty Law Center took the case. So that's a nonprofit. And then the judge broke up. It was 590 men. So they tried a class action suit. The judge broke it up. And so now they have lots of lawsuits. So they had to enlist something like 15 private, big, powerful law firms that did, you know, pro bono work. And it took years, during which people were separated from their families. They couldn't go home. In all that time, I drove to the shipyard with one of them, and now his wife was with him in the U.S. and his kids, but she was in the back seat with my sister. I'm in the front. He's showing me the shipyard. And I said, how long were you separated from your family? And he said, 6 years. And my sister told me later, the wife was in the back miming 7 years in the back of the car. I mean, 7 years to be separated until they could get these trafficking visas, T visas that let them stay, get green cards, bring this lawsuit. You know, it's a long, drawn out process. You can't reproduce that every time somebody gets ripped off.
My question, just from kind of as you've been talking, you've been speaking about how, like, just taking this chap and his wife to the steel yard, and even when you were talking about going to Jamaica and talking to people there, how have you gone about your research? Because it sounds like you've done a hell of a lot of groundwork, of like field work, and obviously it seems like you're using your expertise to in when I say in the legal world, in terms of actually helping some of these workers that get ripped off.
Yeah, this is the problem. The more modern your subject, the harder it is in a way to research, because stuff's not in the archives yet. So for the comparative work that I did on the 19th century indentured labor, I went to the British archives in Kew outside of London. The British saved absolutely everything, organized it very strangely. What a pain, man. I mean, the incoming correspondence is separate from the outgoing correspondence, and the stuff written by British officials is separated from the related stuff written by non-British officials. Even the attachments were separated from the letters that they accompanied. I mean, people, you can see why people tend to write these very narrow single colony studies, because you could spend a lifetime trying to go through the correspondence on one place. And that's just half the correspondence. The rest is in the colony because they didn't have photocopy machines. So that was great, but a bit of a labyrinth. And then I've worked in the National Archives as well because of the role of the federal government. I interviewed at one point a man from Jamaica who had been a colonial official. So the West Indians would come with, they called them liaison officers, so who were supposed to advocate for them. And this guy was so frustrated by how people were mistreated in the cane fields of Florida. But he would always report stuff to his boss, but then it never went up the chain. And he didn't risk his own job by trying to make it public. So he would just, you know, complain, but he documented everything. And he had it in triplicate in a suitcase in his attic. And he took the suitcase out of the attic, it was all mimeographed, and he gave me one third of the papers in the, and that was amazing. And then, of course, I've done lots of interviews. I use government records. I have to FOIA things, you know, do Freedom of Information Act requests and try to get documents, but that's very slow. I've interviewed guest workers, lawyers, employers, although that's tricky to arrange for fairly obvious reasons, but, you know, you try.
We've kind of discussed some of the harms that come to guest workers when the system kind of doesn't necessarily work, but when it works, kind of what are some of the benefits then that some of the guest workers you've researched or studied have actually reaped from this system?
Yeah, well, if you think about the people from, say, Kerala in India, in the Middle East, I mean, it's absolutely central to people's economic well-being, right? So take a country like the UAE, it's 98%. They come from lots of places, but the bulk would be from India and most of them from Kerala. And those people have been going back and forth and bringing back remittances for years and years and years, and making, the estimates I see are about three times more than they could make during doing the same jobs in India. However, they can't bring their families. So if you're a very elite person, like a doctor, you could probably bring your family. But if you're a construction worker, oh no. And if even these guys were sort of the aristocracy of Middle Eastern workers, because they were such highly skilled steel workers, they could not bring their families either. So they're going back and forth, doing this for a period of years, coming home maybe 2 months a year, spending with their families and going back. So, you know, they're missing. This is why going to the U.S. was so attractive to them, because they were promised they could bring their families. And that's everything, right? So so there are definitely benefits, but there's, you know, also real consequences, even when everything goes as promised, right? You're still separated from your family. You're not there for important events. And, you know, in some cases you could fly home and, you know, go to your brother's wedding, or it depends on the circumstances. But the norms can be really bad. Even if people are not treated, you know, terribly, the norms aren't great. So in, say, Hong Kong, the women brought from the Philippines and elsewhere to be domestic workers wouldn't get paid for the first 6 months. And then, so you don't want to leave a bad employer because you're waiting to get paid. You want to at least get paid something before you start another 6 months of no pay. That's, you know, bananas. They didn't have a day off. They had to, like, campaign for a day off. A day off, you know, and that's just the norm. That's not the abusive situations. That's just ordinary, the mundane.
Just kind of going back to the beginning of our discussion, and you spoke about how some of these guest worker programs are evolving out of some of these developing countries in terms of like Australia or South Africa. And some of them seem to be based in anti-immigrant sentiment of, we don't really want them, but we just need them for their labor. Now, how has that sentiment influenced the development and implementation of these programs over time? Because it seems like even some of the cases you're speaking about, like the steelworker chap, it seems like there's some element of, we can kind of exploit this, well, in terms of the employer, we can exploit him because he is an immigrant, or whatever, however they wish to see it. So what is kind of going on there, and how does it work or interlink with these programs?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, because in the case of these steel yards, shipyards are generally pretty well unionized in the U.S., especially the ones that are building Navy ships. They all have union contracts. They're not using guest workers. In fact, they can't. You can't build Navy ships with immigrants unless they're green card holders. So these are shipyards that are trying, the ones that are using the guest workers are shipyards that are trying to undercut their competitors, right? They're trying to market the fact that they can, when they get a contract, they're basically selling labor hours, man hours, they would say. And so they'll say, this is how many man hours the job will take. We can do this for X amount per hour. And that's the whole contract. And if they're late building the ship, or, you know, repairing the oil rig or whatever it is they're doing, the shipyard gets fined, essentially, bigger and bigger amounts the longer they wait. So once they've accepted one of these contracts, they need to make that thing, and they need to make it when they promised it. And they're doing this, you know, by trying to find workers, in some cases who are cheaper, but it's not always, they're not supposed to be paying less than the prevailing wage. In the case of Signal, the prevailing wage with the union guys was about $18 an hour. They were paying $18 an hour. But they're getting a group of workers who will always show up. They're actually living in the shipyard. You know, they're not going to organize. They're not going to make demands. They're not going to go on strike. I guess workers have gone on strike, but in the shipyards, it's like, if you do that, you're out of there. And in fact, when people do start to organize, the companies would like take the leaders and deport them to try to put a damper on the rest. So it's really a system of control. It has the effects, I think, of dampening labor organization, which then, you know, keeps a lid on wages. Even when they're making comparable amounts, if you can't organize these people, can you organize those people? Can you threaten the people who are already in this industry? Well, if you don't behave, we can always get people from X, Y, or Z, right? So it can, in the US though, it's had this whole giant life. It's never been that a big percentage of the workforce. So it's not like 98% in the UAE. It's not even statistically significant. In agriculture, like right now, it's about 10% guest workers, but in some industries, it's been more. So like tomatoes in the 1960s was probably 80% guest workers. But it's had this political import as a supposed alternative to undocumented immigration. So every time there's a hue and cry over the, not the Polonization, but the Mexicanization of the United States and undocumented work, and oh my God, this is terrible, we get a bigger, less regulated guest worker. So this is held up as the alternative, but then people are often treated so badly that they jump their contracts and now they're undocumented too. So when this program began, it was creating undocumented workers, and the undocumented workforce very quickly outstripped the Bracero program, which was the Mexican post-war program. So it was five times bigger within 5 years. So it's never really been an alternative. They've been symbiotic, but definitely the sort of hysteria over undocumented immigration tends to reinforce these guest worker programs as a solution, even when they are not necessarily a solution.
What do you think then of someone who has studied this, written books on it? Like, what do you think are some of the potential solutions to the issues that are associated with these programs? And what do you think are some things that can almost be done like overnight?
Yeah, well, the John Lennon answer to that question is open borders. I think it sounds counterintuitive, but I think if workers can move freely across borders, as they can, say, within the UE, the EU, sorry, I said that backwards, but that's a UE is a union in the United States, then they can all be organized. They can stand up for themselves, right? Think about it. If you, any job you've had, and when you've gone to complain to an employer, my paycheck is short, there's a beam about to fall on my head, you know, this is that, whatever. If you knew that you could be deported for making that complaint, what would that job be like? Right. Yeah. So even though unions historically have fought for immigration restrictions, right, to try to minimize competition, in some ways they've created this problem, right, because they've created competitors who either come as guest workers or undocumented workers who then push down on the wages and conditions. So in 1990, the AFL-CIO changed its policy, its historic position about immigration, and started to say, we don't care about green cards, we care about union cards, and we're going to organize everybody regardless of whether they're documented or undocumented. We're just not going to care. And I think that was a really smart solution. So my pie in the sky wish is that we start enforcing labor rights and we stop worrying about borders. But obviously, John Lennon, that's we can imagine. But when it comes to urgent issues, I think we need to think about that German model post-World War II. We need to separate employers from the power to deport. We need to do that immediately. It's already illegal in most places for employers to confiscate passports, but that violates human trafficking law in the US and UN conventions, but it happens all the time. But so there's some things people are just going to do and they're going to get away with it. But we can't have states set people up to be vulnerable. We have to have states set people up to be powerful, right? And that means taking employers' power to deport away. People must be able to quit and not go home, but quit and go to another employer, which American policy wants called portability. That's absolutely essential. Guest workers have to have the right of collective bargaining, period, end of report. Because otherwise, you know, whenever they try to do anything, they get put on a plane. And in fact, the Signal guys, when they started speaking to a lawyer, somebody ratted them out and the company went to deport two of the ringleaders. And one of them went into the bathroom and he cut his wrists. And that stopped everything. And it's the reason we know about this story. He did that. It stopped that deportation. It got all these sympathetic people involved. And it made us see this world in a way that we hadn't seen it before. But that can't be people's option, right? There has to be a better option than that. So I think we have to do whatever we need to do to make workers more powerful. I think recruitment agencies must be nonprofits. We have to get the profit out of moving people around the world. It was bad in the 19th century and it's bad today. Why can't nonprofits... Unions create hiring halls all the time. Union shipyard workers inform each other of openings. They don't charge for it. We need a union hiring hall around the world for employers to find labor under good conditions.
No, definitely. I definitely agree with your no borders policy, because even in the last few days, we've seen like tragedy in the Mediterranean. Just then kind of wrapping up and kind of focusing more like recently, I guess, is how have these programs continued today? I know you spoke about the shipyard workers and kind of more recent cases that you've helped work on. But how do they exist kind of right now, so to speak? And how do they impact the world around us? Because I think even that stat that 98% are guest workers in the UAE is pretty insane. But like... what else is kind of going on in the globe?
Well, it's a huge phenomenon. Not everywhere. Some countries don't do this at all, or do it in a very, very minimal way, where you might have, you know, temporary visa for a professor coming to teach for 2 years or something. That's a sort of different animal. This is an enormous phenomenon. So there's an American reporter named Jason DeParle who wrote a story in the New York Times, I think, a number of years ago, and he has a great book about this. But his estimate was that if you took all the guest workers in the world and the, on average, 5 family members they support, and you put them all in one place, you'd have 500 million people, or the third largest nation in the world. So this is not a little phenomenon. This is a big phenomenon. And it shifted. So you have these early guest worker programs, Prussia, South Africa, the U.S. during World War I. You get a bunch of other ones during World War I. France has guest workers from China in World War I. Who knew? And then during most of those programs end in the 1930s because of the Depression. So there's more people being sent home than there are coming. And then as the war economy starts to heat up, you get more. So you get Koreans working in Japan. Korea was a colony of Japan. You get lots of people being brought into Germany under guest worker agreements with neighboring countries, all of whom get turned into slave labor in the World War II period. So we have that. And then in the aftermath, those programs get, you know, sort of reinvented and renamed with a sunnier name, but they get much, much bigger. So we have mostly guest workers going into Europe and then into the United States. But then the oil boom happens and the recession happens, right, in the US and Europe, all related, of course. But then we see this huge shift to people going into the Middle East, first from neighboring Arab countries and then from further away. And we have that phenomenon. So we have the sort of oil producing, the kind of Asian tiger nations, Singapore and Hong Kong and so forth, bringing in guest workers. So it's where the next shift will be. Who knows where the next big story will be. Right now, there are about as many guest workers in the U.S. It spiked under Trump, so that we're back to the 1960s peak. So in the 1960s, there were about, by the late 50s, early 60s, the U.S. had about 500,000 guest workers per year, about 4.5 million all told from World War II to the 1965. We're back at that 500,000 per year number. But of course, the U.S. population is much bigger. So as a percentage of population, it's shrunk.
No, it definitely helps. I'm interested, though, to like how or why would they have peaked under Trump? It almost sounds counterintuitive because it's almost like Trump's whole thing is obviously and no immigrants and no, like, nothing, we don't want Mexicans and whatever else. But yet, guest workers coming over almost seems like it doesn't really make sense to me.
Well, yes. And well, first of all, of course, what Trump says and what Trump does are obviously very different things. And in fact, Trump had guest workers at Mar-a-Lago. But the weird thing about immigration in the United States is that the party positions have flipped. So if you go back to the 1950s, the Republican Party was pushing for open borders. It was the party of big business, right? They're pushing for access to immigration. They're arguing against the policing of borders. There literally calls for open borders in the 1950s coming from Republicans. The Democratic Party, as the party of the labor movement, is the one calling for the policing of borders. So instead of right-wing Minutemen going to the Mexican border and making citizens arrest, you had members of the Socialist Party going to the border and making citizens arrest. So it's a little hard to wrap your head around. And of course, over the years, like by the 1980s, those polls have just switched. But employers never quite switched because, you know, lots of employers want access to immigrant workers. And so it all makes for weird, weird politics. And guest worker programs in people's minds seem like the solution. So you can be anti-immigration in terms of permanent immigrants, but think this is okay, just like in Prussia in the 1890s. Well, this is okay because they're going to go home. So it's not necessarily contradictory. People like to imagine that this is the solution to the so-called, you know, supposed ills of immigration.
No, that definitely makes a lot of sense, especially the way you've explained it in terms of how you can hold both views in terms of you can be anti-immigration and yet there's still a need for the labor, but we've put these rules in, so actually they're never going to stay in their minds. Whatever actually happens is different. Yeah.
There's a wonderful academic named Barbara Fields in the U.S. who once said, ideas are promiscuous. People can have competing ones at the same time.
Well, yeah. Well, I guess nothing's quite black or white. Everything's slightly gray. So yeah, it makes perfect sense. I just wanted to double check. I've gotten through the questions that I had in mind, and there's a few that I've kind of crept in as we've been talking. Is there anything that you think is worth mentioning or anything you want to say that we may not have included at this point?
Well, I think it's really important to make clear that the solution to the problems of guest worker programs is not ending guest worker program. You know, it's not trying to block immigration that has historically made workers more exploited, made them worse competition for native born workers and so forth, right? The solution is to make people more powerful, not less powerful. And we know in the United States, for example, that all the money poured into immigration restriction since, say, the 1880s has not led to fewer undocumented people. It led to more by far, because people used to go back and forth across the U.S.-Mexico border. Once you harden that border, you militarize that border, you push people into the desert, you make it much more expensive and deadly to cross the border, people went and got their families and did it one time, right? And now people are here, right? So border restrictions, sending people home, has never worked. It doesn't seem to have ever worked to the benefit of the American workers who think it's going to benefit them. Again, what's going to benefit people is letting people come under less restrictive circumstances where they have more rights and rights they can enforce. And that can't just be on paper. I say this to students all the time. You know, we've got all sorts of rules in the United States about minimum wage and maximum hours and, you know, the overtime pay and OSHA, the occupational safety and health and so forth. And I'll say to them, how many of you have had a job? Everybody puts their hand up. How many of you have ever seen an OSHA inspector or a wage and hour inspector? Nobody. They say, so what do you do when your paycheck is short? You go to your boss and you say, my paycheck's short, right? We enforce labor law. We call the inspectors when it's necessary. People must be in a position that they could do that without fear of reprisal, without fear of violence, without fear of deportation. It's not that, it's kind of a no-brainer if you think about it.
Do you think in some respects, though, it's kind of like the war on drugs in terms of like 20, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, there was a complete like, no, we're going to, or even 50 years ago, we're going to put all this money behind like busting in people's doors and sending, militarizing the police force and whatever. And now when you look at a map of America, like as in there's so many states that have made it legal up to the point of it being recreational in relation to marijuana anyway. Do you think it's going to be a similar thing with this, which at the moment it's almost like hardened borders, militarized the borders, and hopefully over, I don't know what will help the change, but like hopefully over the next few decades that kind of falls? Like, do you think that's a possibility?
Well, yeah, we saw the European Union open its borders to its neighbors, and now we see a huge immigration backlash in those same places. So historians don't like making predictions. It's hard to make predictions, but so I don't know what the future holds. If you go back to when George W. Bush was elected and Vicente Fox were elected, so this is the 1990. Both are elected, presidents-elect, but not presidents yet. They met in Washington, and Vicente Fox talked about opening the U.S.-Mexico border. And George Bush was like, well, I don't know if we can open the border, but we can have a bigger guest worker program, you know, bigger, less regulated guest worker program. And they were chit-chatting about this. And I remember the press at the time, because my head was exploding, because the reporters are going, what's an open border? You know, but that was sort of the direction that things seemed to be going. It was a sort of relatively chill moment in the history of immigration hysteria, which comes and goes. And then 9/11 happened. And there wasn't that much you could do about jerks hiding explosives in their shoes on planes or flying, you know, ultimately there's not that much you can do to prevent, somebody from flying a plane into a building. But so people, I think, turned to the U.S.-Mexican border as something that they imagined that you could steal, right? That we can control. And then all of a sudden, there were pictures of Minutemen at the border with their guns and immigrants tunneling under and climbing over. Most people who overstay their visas fly in on a plane. But it just was the reporters, I think, needed something to film. And so we all just like, started to think about immigration, and it's never quite ended. It's never quite relaxed since then, in part because it got conflated with fear of terrorism, right? The two just got mixed and matched, and here we are. So Will we have a Star Trek future where there's one planet and one planetary government and everybody can go everywhere? I hope so.
No, all right. I like that
but
reply.
Again, rules on paper are pretty useless if people don't have actual power.
Yeah, no, definitely. I just want to say thank you so much. We've spent just over an hour talking, and I've absolutely enjoyed it. I've learned a lot. I've learned a lot, and I hope that we've covered everything in terms of kind of getting the most out of.
I hope not, because I wrote about this for like 30 years, so I hope we haven't covered it in an hour. But
I can't disagree with that. That's absolutely... Quick interruption. Usually we start the podcast with finding out more about our guest of the day. However, with this one, I thought I'd test it and switch things up. So we've put the question of finding out more about our guest at the end of the podcast. Let me know whether you think this is a better structure or not. I'm still trying to figure things out. Anyway, I'll stop yapping and let you find out more about our guest, Cindy Hajamovic.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm Canadian by birth, and then emigrated to the U.S. in 1979 and went to university in the U.S. I got a PhD from UNC Chapel Hill. And I wrote my first book on migrant farm workers in the United States. In fact, I thought I was going to do a totally different thing, and I was going door to door trying to get signatures from faculty members on a resolution to try to raise our pay as graduate students. And a professor just out of the blue said, "When did the migrant stream start on the East Coast?" And I said, "I don't know. Why are you asking me?" And he said, "I've been asking this question for 15 years and nobody knows the answer." And I guess I was curious. I don't even remember making the decision to go work on that. And then, you know, a few years later, I wrote that dissertation. But so it starts in the end of the Civil War and it goes up to World War II. And it was during World War II that the U.S. began importing on a massive scale immigrants on legal, temporary, what we would now call guest worker contracts. There was a much more informal, similar process during World War I, but the sort of state-run labor migrant program began during World War II. And so that book ended, the dissertation ended with that, and it became my first book. And then I just took that last part and said, okay, I need to know more about this, and fell down a rabbit hole and ended up putting it in a more global context, in part because I was giving a talk once at Yale, and a bright Yalee said to me, "Well, you've talked about Jamaicans in the U.S., but what about the workers in other countries?" And I thought, that's a good question. I'll go look that up. And then there was no book that compared. There were books on guest worker programs in different places, but nothing that looked at them all together or tried to figure out when they started. And so off I went.
So you made it to the end of another podcast episode. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did putting it together. If you have any ideas for future podcast episodes, please let me know in the comments below. Normally, I would read off the patrons and our YouTube members that are supporting the Ramblings of a Sikh. However, instead, I'm just going to put it on the screen. Thank you to all our YouTube members. Thank you to our Patreon members. If you want to join and support the work I'm doing, you can do so via the link in the description below. Otherwise, then, I will see you all in the next video.